Hey you, welcome to Bloom Baby Bloom, a podcast dedicated to holistic living, learning, and healing from an African-centric perspective. I'm your host, Maina Chenzi, a holistic life coach, multi-passionate creative, and your dedicated digital soul sister. Hey you, welcome to this episode. We're going to be talking about decolonial love today in the theme of Valentine's Day. I don't, if you know me a bit, I don't usually celebrate such holidays. I don't know, I just never really got into it. I think I just value, just like the way I feel perhaps about even Christmas, I just love everyday kind of demonstrations of stable love rather than these once a year kind of things where we're supposed to go all out. But at the same time, I'm also not a party pooper. Anything that celebrates love, go for it. Or celebrates family time, go for it. Go wild. I'm just saying it doesn't really move me the same way, I guess. But I can still appreciate that this month is dedicated to something as beautiful as that. Like, we do have a part of the month that is about love, and other people in around the world, in America, and other people might also be celebrating Black History Month. Maybe because I've just slowly started thinking that you don't really need a month for that, but maybe it's a month of highlight. I think we should always be obviously making an effort to re-educate ourselves, especially as formerly colonized people in a colonized reality, that we make an effort to continuously learn and unlearn based on the context we exist in and the reality that we have been more or less indoctrinated into. Anyway, so today, guys, I wanted to talk about decolonial love, and I wanted to share just some ideas about what colonial mindset or colonial culture can look like when it comes to love, and the different ways in which we can proclaim our own agency towards love and the kind of love we want to have. I also made a video actually on my channel, May in Bloom, where I just talk about my own approach to free love, or in the sense of like love that you are aware of and you shape in a way that makes sense to you. So if that should be of any interest, check that out. But here I'm just going to be talking more from the colonizing perspective. To start the conversation, I would like to share this line by Jonette Diaz from his speech on decolonial love, where he writes, "We are never going to get anywhere as long as our economies of attraction continue to resemble more or less the economies of attraction of white supremacy." In his speech, he's talking in the different ways in which capitalism, of course, affects how we love. When I talk about holistic decolonization, I'm thinking everything on the axis of oppression and privilege. So that is classism, that is sexism, that is homophobia and racism. So there are lots of axes of power and oppression. And when I talk about decolonization, because the more traditional form of decolonization was more about power structures, or at least removing white people and placing the black people in institutions of power, but the system was still white and the values were still white and the direction of going in progress was still white. So when we talk about holistic decolonial practices, I'm thinking more of the decolonization of the individual and their approach to life as a form of self-awareness, mindfulness, and reclaiming of power by being aware of how colonization was beyond our systems, but also infiltrated the way we do so many things and exist on this planet. So when Jonette Diaz says, "We're never going to get anywhere as long as our economies of attraction continue to resemble more or less the economies of attraction of white supremacy," what we could also replace with that is, "We're never going to get anywhere in love in relationship building, as long as our way of loving and building relationships are modeled towards the very same systems that destabilize those very same things we are trying to reestablish. So understanding how love is preserved in the colonial culture is something I'm going to be touching upon in this episode. For a holistic approach to decolonial love, one has to question how love is affected by patriarchy, heterosexism, classism, skinny worship even, and ableism. All these isms are held together by capitalism and strong colonial mentality, included those embedded through religion. We can undo or practice intentional decolonial love by becoming more curious about why we love the way we love. Basically just asking, is this the only way to do this? Where did I learn this and can I change it? I also want to make it clear that I'm not from the illusion that everything the way we used to do it in the days before colonialism was always the best. Some practice for sure from our past also need to remain in the past. But there is a lot of wisdom that we did lose. There's a lot of ways of approaching love that we did miss out on by simply being forced into the colonial culture that gives only one way of doing things in the guise that it is the best and most progressive and most correct way, which we obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you know that that's not necessarily always true. So it's important that we practice curiosity and intentional effort to learn and unlearn behaviors that might be harmful to us. Colonial love is often based on exploitation and dominance. It is social status seeking venture. It can invite ownership rather than sharing, invite competitiveness rather than cooperation, and it is often at times more about pretense and performativeness rather than rooted in authenticity in a way that makes sense to you, the people in the relationship. So anytime you're in a relationship where you are questioning if this is actually what you want, or if you're just performing what your ideas are, or what you've been conditioned to believe love and partnerships should look like, that's a great opportunity for you to tap into your approach to love and question the colonial framework that you might be using to settle into what you understand love to be. But how do these things show up? In the Eurocentric reality, which many of us are plugged into from birth, sexism is a learned and even encouraged behavior. The most powerful one is the one who is to be the leader and submitted to, not much different from geopolitics and military dominance, where those with the biggest economies or biggest military forces are the ones we are supposed to be following and obedient to. Those who can project the most violence are to be obeyed and followed, while those who are incapable of protecting themselves are at the mercy of the one with the upper hand. This can also be women using emotional abuse as well. I thought that was important to add that in because we always think of violence to be portrayed from its more masculine standing, but women also do practice violence, and they can also practice, obviously, physical violence. But the violence I also have noticed a lot that goes under the radar is emotional violence, which also has as much consequences as that of physical violence. So it's quite important that we do not become blinded to that when we think that violence only comes from one gender and looks in a certain way. And also, of course, men can also practice emotional violence. So what would a more healed approach to this be? Well, a different approach to this is understanding mutually beneficial love partnerships, where wherever one is strongest is an asset shared in the union rather than something to be abused. The strength of one partner is brought to love, to the love table actually, as an offering, and the couple shares them from that table. So if your partner is stronger, you use that to the advantage that is mutually beneficial for the couple. And if your partner is physically stronger, emotionally stronger, financially stronger, resource-wise stronger, more talented, whatever that may be, everything is brought as an offering to the table in which you share from the... You share from the goodness of that strength, and it's not used to coerce, it's not used to manipulate, it's not used to threaten the other partner, but rather it's used in a way to create a better partnership. So that would be the more healthy way of understanding love, which is quite different from the traditional colonial and Eurocentric perspective where things are put in line between the strongest and the weakest, where there is an understanding that whatever strongest should dominate the weak one and manipulate and coerce, but rather we understand that that is a more destructive way of seeing power in those who have it, where power is not necessarily a bad thing, but what we use power for is what creates destruction. So we can also become more aware of that in our own relationships. This understanding is also, of course, practiced in the bedroom. Colonial sex was often a tool of power once again. Sex was and continues in parts of the world to be used as a tool of violence and domination. For example, during slavery or even in the understanding of rape culture, even in the language we use to talk about sex, there is a sense of domination, there is a sense of conquer, particularly when you include patriarchy and sexism to the equation. And the conquering of women bodies and seeing them as notches even on their belt, it's seen as in the same framework you would see imperialism and the conquering of countries and conquering of lands. It's also the same language we talk about when we are speaking in business terms. There is just this idea that the biggest and the strongest and the one with the most power should then go and conquer all the small ones, which makes them bigger and more important and more valuable because they're able to conquer several companies or conquer several women and so forth. So when we think about sex as well, that's something that we have to question and to wonder how that infiltrates and gets into our bedrooms as well. It's also interesting to explore this when we talk about the language we use to even describe sex. If you notice, a lot of the language is, especially in the younger community, the way of expressing lovemaking can often have rather violent connotations. Even just say a word like smashing, you know, basically this idea of a sense of destroying rather than actually engaging in a mutually enjoyable activity. And I'm not saying, obviously, that you can't do that in a way where you are smashing and having an enthusiastically hardcore go at it. But it's just interesting to pay attention to the language that we've normalized without question. And speaking of language, if you truly want to get an insight into how sex is seen in the colonial reality, just visit any adult site. Violence and violation, coercion, tricking, forcing, exploitation, and shame are all the making of the majority of porn plots and titles. Now, of course, someone might want to engage in consensual BDSM. And to be fair, I'm like, it's not my kink, but I will never say anything against people who consent to doing things to each other in a certain way. I'm like, your business. But it's also quite interesting to, I've started questioning that as well. Like, where does that come from, that need of connecting domination in such a way with each other, even though it's from a consensual, why the need for that? Anyway, that's maybe a whole other conversation in itself. And by the way, if you're not aware, BDSM stands for bondage, discipline, sadism, and machismo. It's so funny, I actually didn't know what the other last two were. Like, I remember noticing or like learning about the first two, like bondage and discipline, but sadism and machismo. I think that's quite interesting. But I'm guessing there's a range and diverse amount of people interested in that. And just like I said, if it's happening in a space where there is safety and trust, that is perfectly anybody's right. Okay. So what is worrying, however, is violent and humiliating sex as the main understanding of sex. It is important that we, even in such enjoyments of adult entertainment, that we ask ourselves why we might be attracted to the kind of porn we are. Is it really just fantasy, or is it trauma play? Are we simply too used to seeing sex as something demeaning and shameful, something dirty and violent, and only exciting when there is a hint of humiliation or taboo added to it? And if so, why? Also, there is the entire performance of sex where both partners come into the bedroom, kitchen, or wherever you might be performing for one another, rather than actually being present, honest, and vulnerable with each other. Okay, so a decolonial approach to this, of course, will be agreeing to create a safe space for sexual intimacy where there is open dialogue and willingness to please and enjoy each other with glee and excitement, rather than putting on a show. Unless that is, of course, what is desired, you can role play, then that is also perfectly all right to play roles and change things up a bit according to what you prefer. But sex shouldn't necessarily be a place of insecurity and a place where you don't feel you can be vulnerable to express what you want, what makes you comfortable or uncomfortable, and feel heard, and not like you are putting on a show, but actively enjoying and engaging in what you're experiencing together. I think that sex positive is a beautiful movement also to include in this. And basically, sex positive is a movement that seeks to normalize and change cultural norms towards sex. Sex is, of course, a natural thing, and it's a natural part of our human experience. It's no weirder than the need to eat or rest or be loved. However, from a colonial aspect, sex is given to the African wrapped in shame and fear and disgust. There is the fear surrounding lack of education, abstinence education rather than proactive education. It also invites sexual abuse and manipulation when children are raised in homes without an open space to talk about their bodies and biological changes or desires. Because how can a child, boy or girl, know when they have been violated without the non-judgmental language connected to sex and sexuality? If the only time you hear about sex or sexuality is under the tone of shame, there is that understanding that it's harder for you to even ask questions when something maybe perhaps has happened to you. So having safe environments and also having sex neutral, maybe positive is a bit much, but sex neutral approaches to all things sexuality does also make it easier in those instances for children to talk about what has happened to them and to seek help, and also even to protect them against such things, because they have language for their autonomy and they know what can and cannot be done to it. I think also decolonial love is about recognizing that colonialism was holistically confusing and destructive, an invader that let no area be sacred, not even sex, which is something we all have in common. That's how we all came here. So, but from our bodies to whom we share them with, colonial culture is about commodifying all aspects of our lives and then selling them back to us in distorted shapes and lacking of nutrition. It's kind of like when you buy those really big apples and you're like, oh, look at it, it's so shiny, it's so great, but then you eat it and it has no flavor. Whereas perhaps the more natural apple where the worms eat it and it's a bit spotted has the best taste. It's also important to mention that colonial culture was always justified by church doctrine, enforced by the ego of patriarchy, and kept in place by the threat of violence for anyone who did not fall in line. The letter leading up to those who were most affected by all of this was built and sustained through capitalism / classism, meaning that those who were wealthy and upper class still got away with more deviance than the lower class. And it's also quite interesting because, especially when it comes to sex, that even in things like that, it's the lower class of those who are most oppressed by ideologies that are the biggest champions for them. So whereas those who have the privilege through money or race or gender get to bypass the very same doctrines that they use to punish others with. So that's just a little side note that I found interesting as well. But basically, all these intersectional axes of oppression affected how we love, who we love, and how we even express that love. Then there is also the capitalism aspect of love. I mentioned this also in a conversation I was having on May in Bloom, the video I posted this weekend, just how love between friendship is the only one not commodified, whereas our everyday forms of love, romantic love, are quite commodified in capitalism. And even a day as Valentine's Day is just another example of how something that is usually so abundant and free is then used to sell stuff and to be justified how much somebody loves you based on if they remember or get you anything. Whereas we can all obviously agree that that's not necessarily true. You can be loved and always loved, and your partner cannot care about Valentine's Day, and that will be perfectly fine. But in capitalism, even this is infiltrated in something like that. How we show love and how much we pay for the love we share and so forth. But regardless, it seems as though everything at some point falls victim to capitalism, especially love. When Tina asked us, what's love got to do with it? But really, I think we could have replaced love with money. Because who needs love when a bank is empty? Basically, just even to go back to the history of love and even marriages, this article I found that talked about capitalism and love also mentioned how in ancient days, especially for the wealthy, marriage was basically a way to protect assets. It wasn't a way to proclaim love and to honor love and keep love close. It was more of a way to transfer assets in a way that was protected by law. And the best way to do that was marrying off women to different kingdoms. And that was a way to seal those things. So in the upper class, love in the ruling class was always about advancing and protecting assets rather than true love and companionship. And I also read in that same article, there was a bit that mentioned how when it came to capitalism, you could be loyal to nothing, because at the very end, it was about the advancement of one's capital gain rather than anything else. And I think also this is also something I think about when it even comes to racism, that we wonder what came first. Was it racism or capitalism? Because there is a sort of play between the two, that capitalism has no loyalty and capitalism thrives in competitiveness. And capitalism is oftentimes very attractive to the greedy and those who want to dominate. And they can only dominate and stay greedy if they ensure that those who don't have stay not having. So just basically there is this other underlying motivation when we talk about colonialism and even colonial culture. And it's quite impossible to ignore the connection between capitalism and patriarchy. That's why I love bell hooks' own way of analyzing the issues that we face from an intersectional perspective, because she always talks about all those axes together, white supremacist, capitalistic patriarchy. You cannot ignore it. It's always there in all the things that hold us chained into these realities where we can't live nutritious and filled lives. But by being aware and asking questions, it's one step closer to dismantling them. So hence why we talk about decolonizing our approach to love. So what was I saying? I also found it interesting to see how the separation of love comes into play when you have that underlying importance of capitalism. For example, how the family unit becomes smaller versus community, where family is then a man and a woman and children and their house. There is such a big desire to separate people, because when you separate people, you create more consumers in that way. You don't want your parents and their children and their grandchildren living under the same economy, living under the same roof, because that does not necessarily advance capitalism. Whereas for love and well-being, that does help a lot of people to be close to their loved ones and to create a community within their loved ones. Or even when you talk about the separation of families from their community in efforts to advance themselves financially, that somebody else got a job in another city that they couldn't get where they lived, or they moved countries or what have you. But there is this way of moving away from those closest to us because of capitalism, and that of course also affects how we love and how we approach matters of love when we see that there is that foundation of capitalism that decides what we can and cannot do. I could also say that even when it comes to international love or intercontinental love, there is that as well, because who you love, depending on what kind of nationality they have, can be a big factor in if you guys get to be together. I'm speaking as somebody who has experienced that, that when you love somebody from a different continent, there might be different laws on how that person can come and be with you. Whereas, say, for example, if you fall in love with somebody from the same continent, it's a bit easier and the laws are more forgiving. So there's also all of those like borders that are created and how they affect how we love and who we love, and the accessibility or the ease in which we can be together with people who don't necessarily come from the same land as us. So I thought that was also just a little interesting thing to add into that. But beyond that, there is also the separation between romantic love versus platonic love, in the sense that you give up everything concerning platonic love, which you could also say is community love, for the sake of romantic love. There is this, again, that isolation of love, which of course makes it also harder, because of course in some situation you might feel getting away from your family, I don't know your family situation, would make it easier to have love and keep love. But it's just such a norm that people leave, that people get separated. So you're not creating these strong webs of community, but rather because of love, you're invited to cut the webs of community and go off and be alone somewhere else. And then you'll have kids and they will leave you and go and be somewhere else. And I'm not even innocent of this, because look at me recording this all the way in Lisbon, away from my family. Although I did not come here for love, but capitalism actually could be a reason of, yeah, that was a motivator, even though, yes, obviously it's a beautiful place. But anyway, what was I saying, guys? We can't also ignore, just like I mentioned about capitalism and even Valentine's Day and the commodifying of love, that the language of love is money, or it's shown in the expense of money, in the use of money. Sorry about that. Basically, the whole idea that you will show me how you feel about me by spending money on me, even status boosting, bigger and better weddings and rings and tokens of love, drenched in conflict, jewels and unfair labor. Just the notion even of marriage, what we celebrate and what through this colonial culture, which is also very much a capitalistic culture, there is that idea that the bigger, the better. And even with the rings that you give to your partner, there is also that idea that you should spend this huge amount of money to show how much you love someone. And if you buy a humble ring, then it's also a bit telling of your social status. So capitalism is also infused in that, in how people feel loved and show the love they have for someone. And it's on the marketing scale, it's genius. But on what we need as humans holistically, it's nonsense. I remember when me and my former partner were talking about what kind of rings we would get, it was quite important for me that we didn't buy real wedding rings in that sense. Luckily, he had a friend who could make rings, and we together decided that we would use, I had some jewelry and he had some jewelry and his family had some jewelry, and we put them together to form rings, which I think was so beautiful. And we, instead of having, I don't particularly like diamonds or pearls or any stones like that, I wanted to get a stone that had a meaning or had a heritage of what I wanted to be grounded in this exchange of rings, if we had to exchange rings. But also, I'm not quite particular about even the ring idea, but if we were going to, I thought it was beautiful to have something that was more intentional and not just buying into the whole idea of what kind of ring you're supposed to have. So for me, the stone we used was a rose quartz, just a normal stone, a beautiful stone with a beautiful meaning. And that for me was much more important than, say, look at this big diamond and using that as a token of our love, whereas I don't naturally gravitate to that. But if you do love diamonds, actually, and you do want to get married with diamonds or what have you, or gold, there are so many companies producing ethical wedding rings because they are aware of the conflict that a lot of those jewelries come drenched in. So it's not all hopeless. If you do still want to have that, just you have options, which is good. But since we are talking about rings, we could also address the whole putting a ring on it culture. If he liked it, he should have put a ring on it. Who said that? That's a rhetorical question, we all know. So when Beyonce said that, it's basically about ownership. If you like something, you should put a price on it. You should put a ring on it. You should, here, I will put my bid in, young lady. Because now look, another person liked it and this person has put a ring on it, so you have missed out on a chance with this person, this lovely lady, because you did not take your chance and put a ring on it, right? It's quite fun and innocent lyrics, but it also comes back to that colonial culture, and one that is quite partnered with capitalism, and the idea that putting a ring on it and proclaiming something and owning something is how you show that you love it, that you've documented that this is mine. Okay, so I thought that was also something interesting to reflect on when we talk about decolonial love. That is worded as a form of imprisonment, even like the way we have language around marriage. Say, for example, being tied down, no longer free. As though a paper, a ring, has magical powers and can make love any truer or long-lasting. I mean, does it? Does it really? It can be a token that shows that commitment, but it doesn't have any more magical powers than that. It is all right if you, of course, want all of these things, but just don't be afraid to ask yourself why you want them. And can you get what you truly want in other ways, in ways that feel truer to you? Are you performing love and partnership and relationship? Or are you authentically and intentionally and mindfully engaged in the decisions that you make surrounding love and how you want that love to be formed and the intentions behind the actions you take in those relationships? Because when it comes back to it, humans have been falling in love, building unions, making babies, and caring for them in community long before weddings, dresses, and churches and states could pronounce their love as real or important or legitimate. So basically, just to say that all those things that really matter and make us human have existed long before these gates that we now feel we have to pass through to proclaim that they are justified or that they are good or that they are even legitimate. I remember just even I was watching something and they were talking about illegitimate children. And I was like, that's such a weird term. How do you even defend that? Or even the idea of bastard children, because somebody has been created in non-colonial religious context. That person is illegitimate. It's such a weird thing. It's such that even that language of contracting and ownership and capitalism is kind of infused in even how we see humans being produced out of certain contexts that we deem worthier or less worthier of being produced through. That's also interesting, I think. Yet to end, what is love in its purest form? What is a relationship, a union in its purest form? What are the purpose of all of this? Community. They are for community. They are for connection. They are for longevity and a way to continue humankind. They have always been practiced in indigenous cultures. However, through colonial culture, in hand with capitalism, classism, religious dogma, and patriarchy, all these natural and neutral human and primal needs and expressions are complicated, disordered, detached, sucked of nutrition. And then they are sold back to us in a way that we can sense instinctively that something is off, but then we take on the blame. The blame for finding such natural and neutral human forms of expression so goddamn hard to get, to sustain, to have, without questioning the context and the frameworks that now we feel we have to engage in order to get to those basic things, like I said, community, love, connection, and continuing of the human form, which have always existed and exist for all animals. So the complicating of them and the legalization of them and the putting them in all these dogmas and rules makes them much more complicated than they ought to be. Hence why when we do become aware of that, it's quite beneficial for us to dare and be courageous to ask, could I make this work for myself in a different way? How can I get back to the very basic, the unaltered, in a way of seeing what I want without all these filters of what I think they should exist in? And who taught me this was the only way to get all these things that are important to me? It's quite interesting, even when you look at all these statistics that are supposed to shock us, that say so-and-so percentage of people are not married, particularly black women. Or even when you go back to the continent, this idea that so many women are left to raise kids by themselves and that this is shameful. But who says that's shameful? Of course, it's not good because people should raise kids in community. But again, we are seeing a problem with Eurocentric and colonial eyes in the sense that children should only exist after marriage to a man and a woman, whereas community, again, is much bigger than that. And kids have always existed in bigger contexts than that. And we haven't invented anything new. By thinking that you can't have kids and you can't build a family outside of these frameworks. Of course, just to repeat, if this is what you want, it's perfectly fine, but you should never let anybody shame you for not having that, not wanting that in an environment where capitalism, patriarchy, and all these dogmatic ways of colonial culture have infused themselves into our everyday life, making it seem that there is no legitimate way to get the basic needs of human existence met without the authorization and stamp of colonial values. So just to be aware of that, basically. So basically, what do? Well, we ask questions, as I said. We approach the norm with curiosity for alternatives. And if we choose the status quo, at least we know that we chose it because it is what we want to choose, not because we think it is the only option. We also look back for answers that are more neutral and less exploitative. While not all of our pre-colonial approaches, as I say, to love and sex and even family truly might be inviting us to adopt them, a lot of them will at least remind us that things weren't always how they are today. And if they could be changed then, for whatever motive or desires, foreign or native, they can be changed now too. You are also part of the continuous experience of human existence. And any culture, any tradition, any norm, as a human, you have the right to question and wonder if that makes sense for you. Because no human is bigger than the other human. We all came here through sex. We will die through worms and be digested and back to the earth. So just that practice of realizing that just because it works for some doesn't mean that it has to work for you if you don't feel like it's working. And also it makes certain situations easier to be in because you can question, is this really as bad as I think it is? Or is it my thinking that is making it worse than it actually is? But basically, thank you for spending this love day with me. Hope this podcast has been of benefit and made you think a little more about how you can approach love, sex, and other human natural things in a more holistic and fair, inclusive, grounded, and non-exploitative manner. If you would like some guidance on reimagining your approach to love and romantic relationships from a holistic and decolonial perspective, feel free to book a holistic and decolonial centered coaching section with me, moi, on my website, Bloom Baby Bloom. As I always mention in the beginning of this podcast, I have some open spots available, and for a limited time, I am offering an open price policy, which basically means you are invited to pay for the session at a price that feels true and fair for you and what you need the sessions for. I won't always have this available, but I am listening to my intuition for how long I should offer it before returning to a more fixed price. So I just hope whoever might truly benefit from the session and the open price gets a chance to do so before then. Otherwise, as always, I wish you a lovely day. I wish you courage to stay curious and lots of free, freeing, and grounded decolonial love. I will talk to you and you will hear from me in my next podcast. Bye. I hope you have enjoyed this episode on Bloom Baby Bloom. If you have any questions or comments or just little highs, please feel free to reach out here or on our website at bloombabybloom.com. Otherwise, as always, I send you love, courage, and light to guide you on your path to your truest and most abundant self. You are so very worthy. See you next time. With love, May.